The Lone Sleep Tech Show is proudly sponsored by Open Country, providers of OCM, award-winning systems management software for the Linux Enterprise, and exclusive sponsors of the Webmin Project.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show! Tech Show! Tech Show! Yeah!
The Linux Night Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mind.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
This part we're supposed to talk over now, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah.
It was going to fade out really fast, just like that.
Pick show.
Yeah. This is the show
episode
we've been
164.
This is the show we've been waiting for since we started this.
Yeah, we've been waiting for 3 years, right?
This is it. This is the show. This is the great show.
The show of infamy, show number 164.
And our wonderful, fantastic guest, Patrick Volkerding.
Yay!
Woo! Wow. Slackware!
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, thank you.
As you can tell, we are big...
I'm supposed to give shout-outs to the team. So I'll at least do that for Amrit, because he's the one who requested the shout-outs, but everyone else, too.
And that is to the Slackware team?
Awesome.
Yes, it is.
Because, that's one of our questions right there. Because every time we hear about Slackware, we hear more of about Patrick and not so much about the Slackware team, it seems. But there is a team.
Well, that's true. There is a team. But it's the team that is not a team. We try to avoid the whole officialdom of having a core team, so to speak, because those are the kinds of struggles that are probably best done behind closed doors.
So how?
At least that's my opinion. You know.
How large is this team that doesn't exist?
It's about a dozen people, and they. They do quite a bit of testing. There's a handful of people who contribute code on a very regular basis, and then there's a lot more people who will just send things in through email, and I'll go over them and test them out, and if it's good stuff, it makes it in. If it's not the good stuff, then maybe it gets fixed. Maybe it gets put on the back burner.
So that's the Slackware secret society.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to call it that, but sure, why not? Why not? It's a Slackware secret society. We don't have any handshakes or passwords. Well, we have passwords, but yeah.
So Slackware has the reputation, I think, right now being the oldest surviving distribution.
That's true, and. Yes, I'm probably one of the oldest surviving Linux geeks at this point, too.
Now, Pat, when you started Slackware, correct me if I'm wrong, you did not start this as an offshoot from Yggdrasil, right?
No, it was actually, there was a distribution that was put out by someone named Peter McDonald, who later went on to be of Wine fame. And it was called SLS. And I was working on a project in a class in artificial intelligence for my CS degree. And I needed a Lisp compiler. Well, not a compiler, a Lisp interpreter. And SLS came with one. So I ended up downloading SLS. And it was still kind of in its infancy. And it had some issues with TCP/IP, and it wasn't getting regular updates, and so I started fixing the problems with it. And pretty soon I had half a notebook full of notes about what I was doing, and so yeah, I guess you could say that Slackware may have been the first fork, because it started as a set of fixes for SLS, and just kind of continued from there.
So then Slackware...
Just back up a little bit. Pat,
hold on a
what
second.
What was your first computer?
Sorry, hold on. I just want to clarify one thing. So Slackware wasn't like a Linux from scratch project. It was derived from SLS.
Well, I started by installing SLS. But SLS at the time was, I think you had a boot floppy, and you had 9 system floppy disks, and then you had a smaller set that were for the X window system. And so it has obviously grown quite a bit since then. There's probably still a bit of early residual stuff in there, but for the most part, it's become its own thing, you know, over the years, and has grown substantially.
Cool. Okay, Pat, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ramshout over you.
Pat, what was your first computer?
I'm sorry, what was my first what?
Pat,
computer. What was the first machine you had?
Pat asked, what was your first computer?
Oh, my first computer. My first computer was an Apple II Plus. And I was actually part of a group in Fargo, North Dakota, that we all had home computers back in the 70s. One of the fellows in the group actually had an Apple I. There was an Apple III represented. I was into Apple for quite a long time. I had an Apple II Plus, a IIe. I have an Apple IIe that's been overclocked from 1 megahertz to 10 megahertz, which makes it very difficult to play Apple Panic. The first computer that I ever had any contact with was actually an old PDP that was running Unix back when I was in first grade. And I had the opportunity, because my parents had friends up at North Dakota State University, to go up and play with the computers there. And another friend also had DEC equipment running Unix, and so I remember playing Star Trek on that as a little kid.
So what made you get into Linux then, or how did you get into running Linux?
Well, I liked Unix a lot. I didn't have much access to it. I wanted to learn how to do system administration as well, and it's very difficult to pry a root password out of your average Unix sysadmin. And I know back in 1992, when I first heard about Linux, that I didn't have access to a Unix machine at all, much less have root access and learn how to configure one and learn how, you know, basically learn the ropes. And I was at a Christmas gathering and heard from a friend of mine, Wes, about Linux. He said there's this guy over in Finland who's working on a project to try and recreate Unix PC. And I never had any real interest in the PC before that, but then I had interest then. I guess I'd run some OS too, and it wasn't really what I was looking for. I was more interested in the command line thing. I've always liked the ability of Unix to have the small programs that each have their own, you know, very specialized function, being able to pipe all that stuff together and create something on the spot. But I heard about it at this gathering and got online and found out where to get it, and that was my first interest. It was really interest in multitasking and then learning how to do administration. So, yeah. and that, you know, that was what got me started in it. And the professor in the artificial intelligence class then wanted me to share the fixes that I made and talk to a few people online and who were answering questions essentially on Comp OS Linux. It was before the split on Usenet, and basically told them that some of the problems that you're running into I've fixed, and be happy to let you have a copy of this and set up an FTP site and gave a few copies of it away, and requests started coming in for more copies. And that led to the announcement back in 1993 that I was looking for a place to post it publicly that had some bandwidth, and led to the affiliation with Walnut Creek that went on for a long time. And yeah, that was how it got going. I had no idea at the time that it would be something that would go on for so long. It was just, I thought someone else would pick it up from where I had it, and they would run with it, and it would just be, passing the ball.
So then Slackware was started to continue SLS or to improve upon SLS, and then it just started gaining momentum on its own? Was that it?
Yes, essentially. Essentially, within about a year of launching Slackware, the Linux Counter project was showing it as having 9 out of 10 of the installations that were out there were running Slackware. But at the time, there weren't that many choices. There was still SLS. There were, like HJLU's, boot root disk for the, hardcore do-it-yourselfer, the two floppy sets that would get you up and running and at the prompt, and then you'd have to figure out where to go from there. There was TAMU Linux, the Texas A&M University distribution. There was the Manchester Computing Center, or the MCC distribution. But yes, all historical distributions at this point, but good stuff in the day.
So, Pat, have you ever been approached to sell Slackware to a commercial vendor?
Well, I don't know that Slackware is really something that could be sold. It's open for the taking, and it certainly has been taken more than once, and that's all right. I do get approached by companies and individuals who want to, hire me to do other things, but I kind of feel like I've got this responsibility to the users that are out there and want to, it's not about the money as much as at this point there's not too much even in the genuine Unix camp that continues to do things the way that Slackware does them. Everyone is moving more towards graphical configuration, things like that. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's, one of the nice things about Linux is that just about everyone can find a version of Linux that fits their needs and their skill level, and that's all good. I think, though, that someone's got to be continuing to try to hold up the old school ways and to try and, send the people into the et cetera directory and configure things with VI, and that's part of what Slackware is about. Part of it is about respecting the wishes of the many developers that produce the components that go into it. I try to leave things alone for the most part as I get them, and not try to add new features. I'll fix bugs if bugs are serious, and otherwise features are something I think that the project teams that make the components should be concerned with.
So is Slackware, your idea of Slackware then is, and the team's idea is to present a usable configurable distribution that is provides mainly vanilla packages, so to speak, that are, you know, set up the default manner that the developers intended?
Exactly. That's in vanilla is actually the word that I use quite commonly. The kernel is a good example, because I don't think there are many Linux distributions left anymore that still ship a kernel that's the way they got it from ftp.kernel.org. And that's part of the, I don't know quite what to think about that. It seems like all the distributions want to make a little change here and a little change there, and that's all right, but it leads to incompatibilities among the different versions of Linux, and I think that it's better just to leave things the way they are and to essentially give people a system that's what they would have got if they'd gone and installed it all themselves.
Yeah, one of the since Slackware 11 just recently came out, last week, I believe it was, I had read a review that somebody had posted. I think it was on Linux.com, or I'm not sure where it was. And one of the criticisms they had issued at Slackware was the fact that some of the default settings on certain window managers, like I think it was Fluxbox was an example, and Window Maker, are populated with applications that are not part of the Slackware distribution. And they said, well, you know, why did you leave those options in the menus if they don't exist?
Well, as far as Window Maker and Fluxbox and things like that, I'm including whatever default menu items that they ship with. Back when the window manager was FBWM2, I did actually go to quite a bit of work to make sure that the applications that were listed in there were all things that existed in the distribution, and that you could, you know, count on being able to click on something and have it run. Now there are quite a few window managers, and it would be, while I think it's kind of outside of the scope for one thing to try and alter those menus to make sure that everything is where it should be. It's a valid criticism to bring up, because it is confusing for people. But on the other hand, I think that Fluxbox and Window Maker are probably used more by the experienced user compared to something like KDE, where when you bring up KDE, everything in those menus is going to be found.
I get it. That makes sense. On the reverse of a criticism, I guess we could say, is unlike most other distributions out there, Slackware comes with support for MP3 playback using libmat out of the box, which a lot of other distributions kind of shy away from providing that kind of software due to licensing issues. What's your thoughts on that? I mean, why did you choose to include libmat?
Well, I do, to the best of my knowledge, follow the licenses. I don't include any MP3 encoding software, which there is a very clear license that is owned by Fraunhofer and Thomson that has to do with the process of encoding MP3s. I haven't seen any patents having to do with the decoding of MP3s. I don't include DVD CSS. There are things like that I, to the best of my ability, I follow licenses, and not everyone does. I think that the MP3 playback issue could have been potentially just a bit of paranoia on some people's parts. And as far as I had, my understanding is concerning MP3, that the issue with MP3 and playback is with hardware devices and not with software. And I have not heard of any of the various groups that are making software to play back MP3 having any sort of trouble the way that, like, say, for instance, the LibAC3 people did.
That's good. And you make a good point there, and that would be interesting to see whether other distributions may pick up on that, that the playback doesn't necessarily violate the license, it's the encoding.
Yeah, well, I know that they are attempting to charge, and it's not very much, but they are attempting to charge a license fee for MP3 playback, but the evidence doesn't seem to be there that there are patents on playback, just on encoding.
Great. Well, you know, I hope that some more athletics people take your approach view from that.
That's understandable.
So what's your
if someone tells me to take it out, I will.
So then what's your opinion on with Linux on the desktop, one of the big issues has been not just MP3 support but video codec support. What's your general opinion about that? Are you hoping that one day to see that Linux itself can include those codecs and not have an issue with licensing?
Well, to be honest, I can't see codecs that are like, for instance, the Windows Media Video codecs, QuickTime, things like that. I can't see them being open source. And part of the reason is that the companies that produce these codecs, they don't have a financial incentive to open source them. But also, in other cases, they may be licensing the technology from someone else. And they, you know, even if they wanted to open source it, they might not be able to. What I'd like to see happen is more of the open codecs being supported more widely, the odd-based codecs, Odd-Vorbis and Ciora, is that how that was pronounced? I guess I've never really understood that one, but that was added as one of the things in SlackWare 11, is that is a playable video codec through the Zine engine, and to my ears, the OGG format sounds much better than MP3, and I store all of my own music in OGG format. And I think that that's really the direction that it ought to go for the most benefit for Linux and for open source, is to go to open source codecs rather than to try to reverse engineer or compel or beg or whatever a company that is and produce a proprietary codec to open up the stacks or to open source the codec itself.
So I guess
okay, Patrick, how about...
Go ahead, Dan. No, go ahead. I don't want to run...
Just going to ask you about package management. It's one of the important things that we see with, especially with a lot of the new users, is they want an easy way to manage getting software on and off of their computers. And... do you have the inclination to ever include a default package management tool that would handle dependency checking?
No, I don't think I do. My issue with I have several issues with dependency checking. One of them is that not all of the developers who are producing shared libraries really follow the rules of when to bump a major number. And I'm sure everyone out there understands what that means, that if the version of a shared library, that first number after the .so goes up, then everything has to be recompiled. And technically, if you've got some sort of a change to the application binary interface that's not compatible with the previous version, then that number should change. But there are some libraries out there, like, for instance, libcups is one of them, where not only do they not change the major version number, but they don't change the version number at all. The a new library comes out and it's not entirely compatible with the old one, and it still has the same number. So if you're trying to do a dependency system on something like that, you really don't have a good way to know whether or not the functions that a program needs are really going to be there or not. It does help a little bit, perhaps, in terms of bringing in maybe a new required library that someone wouldn't have known that they needed. But I think that overall, it possibly does the system more harm than good, because it makes people think that it's safe to do an upgrade that may perhaps bring in updates of a lot of other libraries and perhaps break other things on the machine. And plus, the Slackware community is pretty well known for being self-reliant and for wanting to compile their own software. And perhaps you've compiled something and it stands as a dependency for something else, and maybe you're in fact using a development version of something. And in cases like that, you don't want to be installing a package and having it go, oh, you don't have such and such that's a dependency installed, and it goes out and it fetches an old version of something and it plops it down on top of the thing that you've compiled from Subversion or something like that. So, you know, there are pluses and there are minuses to both systems, and I think that it's good to have at least one version of Linux out there that doesn't enforce that.
You bet. How about people want to know about Soiret and Slapget. Do you use either one of those?
Yeah. There's several of the management systems are out there. We actually include one from Peter Punk that's called Slack Package. And I like that one because its mode of operation is just to try to keep a distribution in sync. It doesn't look at version numbers of something. There have been times where I've upgraded a package, say in current, and the new package turns out to be not working for some reason. We have to go back to the old package. And not all of the automated upgrade tools understand what to do in that situation. They see that the version that's installed has a bigger version number than the one that's on the site, and they don't want to back it out and switch back. And so that's one of the issues, is that in order to avoid the full dependency thing, you have to kind of run a full system so that you know that you're not missing anything. From the people who do use those, who talk to me, for the most part, those systems do work pretty good. But I think that Slackware is more for the people who are going to be going out and reading the changelog and figuring out what needs to be updated, or running something like Slapget that will only go out and get the critical bugs.
So then,
all right, now how about another? Go ahead, Dan.
So then, so what you're saying is the package manager that comes with in the extra software of Slackware is designed for primarily keeping the distribution in sync with the main repository, and the other package managers that people have developed, like Soiret and Slapget, kind of transcend with the kind of intent of Slackware is of rolling it, you know, getting a base system and rolling your own software to go into it, is what you're saying, right?
Well, I don't know. The deal with Slapget or with Soiret, I think they'll follow any of the distributions, and typically once a distribution is released, the only changes that take place are in the patches directory, and for the most part those are going to be either security updates or important bug fixes, and they aren't going to be feature enhancements. So it's safe to use any of those kind of tools to track the patches directory. When you start getting into going to third-party repositories, then you might have a different situation going on. Like, as an example, I had a few people who were writing to me after the Slackware 11 release saying that I had compiled curl without HTTP support. And this confused me for a while because I was thinking, you know, that's the whole point of curl is to retrieve HTTP URLs, and later a lot of other protocols got added to it, but there's no way that I would leave HTTP out, and I'd be hearing about it a lot more than just from a few people if I did something like that. And I finally had someone run LDD on their curl binary, and it was finding a version of libcurl that was bundled with OpenOffice. So you can run into problems like that.
So what's your feel, then, on some of the other third-party repositories? I know that, that you kind of endorsed Dropline when you moved GNOME out of the Slackware main distribution. I guess there's, what, Linux Packages is another repository that's available?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's also another repository that some friends are working on that I believe is called slackbuilds.org. And one of the nice things about that is that they don't actually distribute the binaries. They only distribute the Slack builds. So it's kind of similar to something along the lines of the FreeBSD port system. And that, too, would get around the issue of dependencies, because if you've compiled an extra application on your system, it's going to link against the libraries that are on your system, and so you're not going to end up bringing in a library that breaks something that way. As far as the third-party repositories, I think it's good that they're there, and the quality of the packages kind of varies. Some of them are really good, and some of them are not quite as good. And as far as Dropline, I'm not sure I'd given them quite as strong as an endorsement as the FreeRock system and the GWare system. And probably the main reason for that was that they replaced the entire version of X11 that was shipped with Slackware, and I think they also added PAM support. So it kind of taken Slackware in enough of a different direction that I almost consider Slackware with Dropline running on it to be almost a fork rather than the actual system.
That's right. I'm sorry. I thought it was I remember when Dropline first came out, and that just stuck in my head. Sorry about that.
Yeah, the Dropline is all right, though, too. I've run it myself. I've run you know, all three of those, and just to test them out, and I didn't find any functional problem with it, and so I think they're doing good work too. They just are going about it in a little bit more of a possibly an invasive way.
So the rumors that you hate the GNOME people are like unsubstantiated, then, right?
Oh no, not at all. It just got to be too much, and it was hard to know actually which versions of what worked with what else. You almost had to be a member of the team in order to know the magic combination. So that was the primary reason for outsourcing the continued development for Slackware to other parties. And I think that it's worked out for the best, because you get a group of people that know that better than we knew it, and so they've added more software, and I think that it's been a better thing all around for everyone.
So what's...
But no, I think that they're also doing good work, so yeah.
So what's up with sticking with the 2.4 kernel series? When do you think Slackware is going to move to 2.6 by default?
Well, okay. The reason that Slackware 11 came out supporting both the 2.4 and the 2.6 is that I felt like there needed to be not only a distribution that sort of straddled both kernels and provided the ability to run either one, but that there also needed to be like some, if 2.4 is going to go away, which it very well might go away in the next release, that there needed to be one last good release with 2.4 as the kernel that is being supported. I expect that people are going to be running 2.4 for quite a long time. I know that when patches go out, even for distributions that are as old as Slackware 8.1, I see a lot of people going to fetch them. And I know a lot of servers that are out there are still running old versions of Slackware, and there are a lot of people who consider the 2.4 series to still be more stable than the 2.6 series. So that's the main reasons why. 2.6 has got a lot more features. So that, it was a decision made to sort of let people decide which direction they wanted to go, and perhaps if they were running a server that had relatively light duty, that they would want to run 2.4 for a longer uptime, and if they were running a multimedia workstation and they needed the modules to do things like digital video and stuff like that, that then they were going to need the 2.6 support.
So how come it's so hard to get the 2.6 running off the installer?
I think the big thing that people run into with that, and if it weren't for the fact that 2.4 is probably going away the next time, I would address this. But it's really not that hard to install using 2.6. You just have to, when you get to the boot prompt on the install media, you either have to type fuge26.s or test26.s. But here's where the mistake gets made, is that after all the packages are installed, you get presented with this kernel selection menu. And if you don't say, install a kernel off the CD, and then pick, it will default then to suggesting that you install the test 2.6 or huge 2.6 kernel. If you don't do that, the machine is going to try to reboot on 2.4. And that causes trouble.
And we call people who don't understand that noobs, Link. Noobs.
That's right.
Well, I think that's, that's a trap pretty easy to fall into, but it's also one that people can get a quick answer to if they go out to, like, linuxquestions.org and they say, I just did such and such, and here's what happened. Everyone's going to recognize that one.
Speaking of linuxquestions.org, that's pretty much the default forum for Slackware support, isn't it?
Yes, I would say it is. I met Jeremy Garcia at one of the Linux Worlds in San Francisco at the Moscone Center, and we talked about that for quite a while. I think I spent a couple of days in their booth, and pretty much that is where that's the first line of support. I guess I'm probably the last line of support. I do get quite a few support questions that are sent directly to me, and I do quite a bit of my share of Linux support too, so I'm kind of a jack of all trades here.
Yeah, we know Jeremy. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he is.
Now, Slackware, for the past couple of releases, and I'm going to say at least till Slackware, I think, 8, I have an official Slackware 8, has been coming on. If you buy the official package, it's 4 CDs. You got the Slackware main, and then you got the KDE CD, and the extra CD, and the source. You seem to be kind of sticking to keeping it at those 4 CDs. Is that one of your goals, to make it so that, I mean, if you want to run Slackware, you only really need one CD? And, I mean, or do you foresee...
Well, It's interesting that you mention that, because this time around, and I think part of it had to do with the inclusion of two major kernel series, but there were other things that expanded as well. KDE added a lot more language support, which tends to be rather large, and so we really didn't know until close to the release date whether or not we were going to be able to fit it onto four CDs or not. And as it turned out, we were not able to fit it onto four CDs. We had to use six CDs. And we went ahead and just shipped that out to the people who had ordered it and didn't charge any extra, but we were still able to get the basic system, including X11, onto the first disk, so that you have essentially everything except for KDE, and I think Tech also ended up on the second disk. And then the third disk is the language support for KDE. So there are now three install disks, and the first one being the most important, having the kernels and having the system minus KDE and Tech. And then the second one being the second most important, having KDE and Tech. And then the third one, unless you need the language support for KDE, you can leave that one out. And also, we did do a DVD this time for the first time, and that helped quite a bit. It gives me a bit more breathing room to think that, you know, we'll have more space for future expansion, because definitely for the last several releases, it's been really hard looking at four CDs and thinking, how are we going to make this fit? And we just recently talked about the removal of GNOME from the standard package list, and in spite of that being outsourced to other projects to manage, that version of Slackware was still bigger than the one before.
Go ahead, Pat D. Sound like you're about to say something.
I have a question for Pat.
My God, we caught him speechless.
He was in the middle of typing too.
What's your opinions on UDEV?
Yeah, the question was. Oh, sorry, I didn't know if you heard him.
No, I didn't.
Oh, his question was, what are your opinions on UDEV?
On UDEV? Well, it was a lot of work to get it to function. I guess that I like the new UDEV in terms of speeding up the boot, but I liked the old separation of hot plug and UDEV previously, even though it was a little bit of a slower boot, because you didn't have to use UDEV, although I suppose you still don't have to use UDEV. You can set up your config file and have your dev directory that's filled with static device nodes, and you can have a UDEV directory where it puts everything that it finds, and go ahead and just keep using dev if that's what you like. That's something that we'll be looking ahead to in this next release of Slackware after, you know, now that we've just had 11.0 come out. The things that we're looking into right now are bringing the tool chain up to date, which is something that we like to do right at the beginning of a development cycle, so that you've got plenty of time to work out whatever surprises you get with that. And we'll be bringing in the latest UDEV and probably HAL and DBUS and PMount and whatever else is needed to support all those sorts of things. And yeah, I think that UDEV is going to, you know, it definitely is playing a role in making Linux more usable for people who want to do desktop type work and be able to plug in a digital camera or a piece of flash memory and have it just pop right up on the desktop. So I think that overall it's going to be a good thing. It's been something, though, that's been hard to get it all to work just exactly perfect. It's taken several of us working on it to to get it to function the way we want it to, but it shows a lot of promise.
You know, we've circled around Slackware 11, and you've mentioned some of the new things like Theora support. What other new things have been added to Slackware 11 that might differentiate it from Slackware 10 as opposed to just, you know, updates of the standard software?
Oh, boy. You know, I get asked that all the time, and I'm so busy with updating stuff that I tend to overlook what exactly is it that's new. And people say, what's the big feature this time? And I don't know what the big feature is this time. I'd have to think about that some. I think that the big feature the next time is probably going to be the tool chain getting updated and the move to a modular X and things like that. This time, I think, you just mentioned UDEV. UDEV took a lot of our development resources this time. I don't know. I just like to think that it works better than it did before. I guess that's about all I could say about that, is that as the things get updated, they tend to improve. I like to, let things sort of cook for a while before they get added. I'm not real... not real trigger happy about adding things to Slackware. They've got to prove themselves out in the world, and then they've got a lot of people writing to me saying, this really needs to be added, then I'll go, okay, and we'll talk about it and decide what to do. And yeah, I should be on IRC right now having the team prompt me. They're probably yelling at each other right now, going, why isn't he mentioning, something? Wireless support, I think, is maybe one of the new things that's taken a stride forward. One of the team members, Eric, has done a lot of work with that and has put together things like the WPA supplicant, the 2.6.18 kernel brought in, actually, I think it was the 17 series, but also the 18 brought in a lot of new wireless drivers. It brought in native support for Broadcom for the first time. So things like that, I guess.
So we won't expect to see Compiz or Barrel showing up on Slackware proper anytime soon.
What's that?
We won't expect
to
see...
see what?
Compiz or Barrel showing up. XGLX or the AIGLX 3D desktop enhancements?
Well, you might expect to see them. It depends on whether or not they show up as standard features in the Modular X. If they do, then they'll be there.
All right, there we go. So then, what about Slackware supporting other architectures? I know there's other projects out there that support AMD 64, that support PPC. Is the main Slackware team only interested? Yeah, Spark. Is the main Slackware team pretty much interested in the x86 architecture, or will we see, maybe someday in the future, more support for other architectures?
Well, right now the only architectures that are official Slackware architectures is the IA32, the 32-bit x86. And the interestingly enough, the IBM S 390 that Mark Post's Slack 390 distribution supports. There's been a couple of unofficial ports to the AMD 64 architecture, and I do have one of those machines here, and that is one that I have my eye on for an official port. I think that in some ways, a lot of the people who would be thinking that they want to run a full 64-bit distribution might find that they really didn't want to run a full 64-bit distribution, because if I do that, I'm not thinking that I'm going to be doing the multi-lib type of support where you can run both 64 and 32-bit at the same time. What I would probably do is a direct port where it's a full-on 64-bit, and not everything out there is available yet for 64-bit. And it might be kind of an eye-opener for some people to find out just how reliant they are on proprietary binary software. Just for some examples, I don't think that there's a Java out yet for the AMD 64 on Linux. If there is, correct me. I don't know. There might be. Things like video drivers and stuff like that may not be available for AMD 64. And, I think that that's the way that the Debian project is doing it as well, or at least the last time I had checked, their port to the AMD 64 was a pure 64-bit port, and they said that if you wanted to run 32-bit applications, that you should install a 32-bit version into a directory and chroot into it. So that might be the road that we would follow as well. But it's something I would like to see, just because I know that there are people out there who are running servers and that they're running into the memory limits and that they want to see Slackware support gigs and gigs and gigs of RAM. So I can understand that. For somebody who's just running Linux at home, I think that 32-bit is adequate and probably has the same performance that they would get from 64-bit. So I've been satisfied to run 32-bit Slackware on my AMD 64 and haven't felt like I'm missing out on anything because, well, I only have 1 gig of RAM in the machine, so I don't know how much of an improvement I'd be able to get out of it by running 64-bit.
Pat, will there ever come a day when you have to say, you know, I have to hand the project over to somebody? Will you ever do that at some point?
You probably didn't.
Someone's going to have to translate that one for me again.
Yeah, Pat speaks Vietnamese, sorry. No, he had asked if there will ever come a day when you will probably have to, or you plan on handing the reins of Slackware over to another person.
Well, I don't intend to live forever, so if the distribution is going to continue at some point, I would think that that there would be some sort of a handing over of the reins. There's nothing like that that's planned for the immediate future. There are plenty of qualified individuals out there, and a lot of them already are working with me. But, yeah, I enjoy working on it quite a lot, and so I'm in it for the long haul. But there are contingencies in place, and there are other people who are ready to take command, and there are also several forks out there that are of pretty good quality, and so I think that the Slackware way of doing things is going to continue no matter what. So that's the beauty of open source. If you've got a company that just evaporates, that's a proprietary company, that's that. You know, you won't see new releases of CPM or OS2, or maybybe you will of OS2. I don't know if they ever let that one out or not. I guess they did with Rex. But yeah, there's no plans at this point to hand control over to anyone outside of the team, and we accept input from anyone. We welcome people to contact us and give us their ideas and lend a hand where they can do so. But for now, it's that's how it's continuing to be run the way it's done for quite a long time now.
I gotta say, I remember when I first really got into Linux about 7, maybe 8 years ago. the big thing that I recall hearing back then was if you wanted to run Linux, you can run Red Hat or SUSE or any of those other distributions. But if you really wanted to learn how to run Linux or learn about how Linux operates, Slackware was a distribution to use. And when I picked up on Slackware about a year after I started using Linux, that taught me so much. And it's been such a wonderful, solid distribution for learning. My hat's off to you for what you developed there. And it's amazing to see people, you know, who have been in Linux 2 or 3 years and who have used, you know, like, you know, SUSE or Ubuntu or some of the other distributions, who I don't think get a lot of times, if you just stay with the standard utilities that they provide, get a full understanding of how to use, you know, how Linux actually operates. Because, you know, from using Slackware, I can take that knowledge and apply it to any other Linux distribution and know, hey, if their tools aren't going to do what I need to get done, I can get down and dirty on the command line and do it. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad that glad you like it. I'm glad it's taught you a thing or two. I know it's taught me a thing or two. At the time that I first started this, I look back on it and I think, back then I thought, oh yeah, I'm qualified to do this, and now I look at it and go, no, I wasn't. But you learn through your own mistakes, and maybe some of the things you learned were fixing some of my bugs. I don't know. I hope not too many of those, but I think that what you've said is true, that because of the overall lack of graphical setup tools and things like that, you're forced to get down there, you're forced to read the README files in spite of the well-known README encryption system, and you have to get into the config files and learn how to configure things. And I think that one of the things that stands out when you compare a system where you configure things graphically to where you're actually getting into the config files and making changes yourself is that when you use a graphical configuration tool, you're typically looking at a subset of what the software is capable of. They don't want to confuse the user with too many options, so what you're looking at are the options that whoever wrote that setup tool thought were the important ones, and you lose some of the flexibility of the software. And so, yeah, you know, that's one of the things that I like to think that that we do is train people on how to get in there and how to work around issues that you just can't work around with a graphical tool. So, yeah, that is one of our goals, and thanks again for the kind words.
Now, do you yourself see Slackware as more of a server-based distribution or a desktop or a combination of both?
I see it as a combination of both. It's kind of a fine line there. It's a balancing act, really, because the desktop direction seems to want features, and it wants things that may or may not be entirely secure. And the server end of things, you're not looking for max performance as so much as you're looking for stability and security. So I try to strike a balance between those two things. I like to make it so that I want the network services that start by default and that are used for a server. I want those to be bulletproof. I want them to be stable. I want them to be well audited and the latest versions. And for the desktop, I want the desktop to be, again, the latest versions that are going to meet those requirements, that are going to be stable and secure and that aren't going to interfere with using Slackware as a server operating system. But there's there's going to be more of the desktop orientation, but again, it's not going to be at the expense of security, because that and stability to me are the most important things in the operating system.
So speaking on the server side of things, what's your opinion of Apache 2? Because I know like Slackware comes with Apache 1.3 series.
Yeah. At the time that Apache 2.0 came out, there were still quite a few people who were using Apache extensions that weren't yet supported by the 2.0 series. And 1.3 has been absolutely stable for me anyway. And also, just reading BugTrack and full disclosure, there's a period of time where the majority of the reports that had to do with Apache had to do with Apache 2.0. So I felt like we were making the right choice there in terms of going with something that was a known commodity, something that all of the software that people wanted to use with it was available for it, and it was, you know, not going to do anything that would be surprising to them. The principle of least astonishment. And now that the Apache people have come out with the 2.2 series, we are looking at retiring Apache 1.3 and moving on to Apache 2.2. It looks like pretty much everything that people want is available for Apache 2. And the security issues have been resolved pretty much entirely. I don't see any more security problems coming up with either, 2.0 or 2.2 versus 1.3. So it was just a case of giving it some time to settle down and to be road tested, and I'd rather have the road testing happen elsewhere and not use the Slackware community as the beta testers when what they're looking for is a production system. So that was the rationale behind that, and it just seemed like it was a little bit late in the development cycle to think about swapping in Apache 2.2. I suppose it could have gone into testing or something like that, but at a certain point, you got to draw the line and say it's time to get a release out, because you can just keep changing things forever and never get a release out. And so you have to get something out, and then you can get back to the business of breaking everything.
Pat, what do you think of the current distros that are out there? There's a big push for the desktop, with Ubuntu. What do you think of the current status of SUSE under Novell?
Pat's question.
It's definitely at a very low volume on this, so I can't understand.
Yeah, Pat's question was, what do you think of the current distributions that are out there, the crop of distributions, primarily from the standpoint there's a lot of focus on the Linux desktop these days?
Yeah. What are my opinions of the other distributions that are out there? That's the question. As far as the desktop?
Right. I mean, what's your opinion on what's going on with those these days?
Well, it's interesting to watch it and to see, what's going on. The popularity of the live CD has been sort of interesting to watch, because that was something that we pioneered back in the mid to late 90s when we first moved to a 4-CD set and we only had 3 CDs to fill, we figured out how to make a bootable live CD, and then later we didn't have space to include it, which disappointed a few people, but there's Flax is out there if people wanted a bootable Slackware-based CD. The Ubuntu phenomenon has been interesting to watch. Again, there's different things for different people. One of the big stumbling blocks, I guess, for someone who's brand new to Linux and who wants to try Linux out, and if they wanted to start with Slackware, is that you boot Slackware, and the very first thing you're faced with is the command line, and you've got to run fdisk and figure out how to do partitioning the old-fashioned way. And I think that that kind of sets a hurdle in a way. And I think that most of the graphical desktop-oriented distributions will give you some sort of a graphical tool so that you can do things like that. But I've always shied away from things like that, especially with fdisk, because I don't want to be responsible for someone clicking OK and deleting their whole system when that wasn't what they meant to do. So, but it's the desktop operating systems have come a long ways in terms of usability, and I think that it's a good thing to see, because you know a lot of the other operating systems are plagued with viruses and spyware and things like that. And it's nice to see a system that you can set up so that it looks, you know, pretty much like any other desktop operating system that you might encounter, and go set something up for someone and be able to leave it there with them, and you know that they're not going to have those kinds of problems. If someone sends them a virus and they click on it, it's not going to do anything. So I think that that's the kind of market that perhaps they're targeting, and it's good that someone's out there doing that.
So what are your thoughts on the BSDs these days? I know Slackware is one of the few distributions that use the BSD style of scripts. What are your thoughts on the BSDs?
Well, I think that the BSD Unix actually was some of the first Unix that I was really got involved with. Sun OS, actually, before they made the switch to being Sys5 based. I think that the BSDs are also an interesting group. I think that maybe their philosophy is a little closer to mine than a lot of the other versions of Linux. I have a lot of respect for OpenBSD because of the work that they do with OpenSSH. I've got a lot of respect for FreeBSD as well. I worked very closely with FreeBSD in the Walnut Creek days because we were both under the Walnut Creek umbrella, so I would see their developers on a pretty much daily basis, and a lot of technology was traded back and forth between FreeBSD and Slackware in those days. I think, in fact, you can still look at the etc. services file in Slackware and see a FreeBSD stamp in it. So it's the BSD people have created quite a legacy, and I think that the extra tools that they made that went on top of the AT&T Unix really laid the groundwork for a lot of what Richard Stallman did later, that the GNU tools were pretty much extensions of the already extended BSD tools. So they've certainly been a huge influence, and I think that that it was really BSD 386 that got the whole ball rolling as far as free and open operating system. So, yeah, BSD is way cool.
So
way cool. That's what we think, too.
Yeah. So Slackware is on version 11 now. It's a solid distribution. It's been going on for a long time. Has Slackware... is that your main job? I mean, is that what you do? You work on Slackware? Or is Slackware a side project for you?
Slackware is my main job, yes. The people who are kind enough to subscribe to it or to buy something from our store, they're the people who keep the lights on here. And I work on it full-time, so that's been my full-time job now since... about 94-ish, The first year or so, I worked on it for free and was essentially, I guess, technically unemployed. But since then, it's been enough to get by, and that's all I'm asking for. I just want to be able to keep working on it, so that's it.
Now, if I may ask this, is the money from Slackware, is it from the distribution itself, or is it from support? Like, are you selling the distribution, or are you selling the service of support?
We're selling the distribution on media, and then things like T-shirts and stuff like that, just to help support the project. There had been a time when we had paid support, and that was back when I was working for Walnut Creek, and they had a support team there. At this juncture, we really don't have the resources to provide paid support. I think it would take us away from developing the distribution itself. It's something we could look into, perhaps, but we would have to hire people to do paid support, and we'd have to know that the need is out there. And I think that a lot of the people who run Slackware are pretty self-reliant, and so we pretty rarely get requests for paid support. I think that the market for paid support is essentially among enterprise Linux, and unless you've got a system admin who feels like they can support Slackware, that the managers always feel better about going with a large company that's got paid support, and so a lot of the contracts for paid support and the interest in paid support is directed at companies like Novell and Red Hat and stuff like that. So I don't know what extent the market is there for paid Slackware support.
So when you're not working on Slackware, what do you like to do? I mean, what kind of other hobbies do you have?
Well, I like to work on my car. I got an old Firebird ragtop from the 60s and ran that in the local parade here. I moved back to Minnesota and live in a small town. I'm enjoying small town life again after 6 years in the Bay Area. I like to just spend time with my family. I've got a daughter who's almost a year old now. I like music. I like to play music. I play a lot of instruments. I play one of the most despised instruments on the planet, which is the five-string banjo, and a lot of other instruments, too. Those are some of my hobbies that I enjoy. Like to listen to and make music really is the big thing, and also like just about everyone else, I'm a web junkie and like to follow what's going on the various news sites, and you know.
So do you record any of it? Is there some place that we can go to listen to Patrick Volkerding pick the banjo? I'm hooked now.
Did you hear of any of what Link said?
What's that? I didn't hear that.
Oh, he was asking whether you have recorded any of your banjo picking there, because he's hooked now and he wants to hear Patrick on the banjo.
You know, I don't think I have recorded any of that. I probably could. I could record a little bit of it or do something along those lines. I actually built a banjo from a kit that's made. Called the Banjovi. It's a little ukulele-sized five-string banjo, and it took about a year to put this thing together because I decided I wanted to use lacquer on it, and I didn't put down a sealer coat. And so the wood, which was black walnut, just every time I put another layer of lacquer on it, it would just drink it up, and you'd just see it soaking into the pores. All the wood pores would reappear. I think I probably emptied 5 cans of spray lacquer on just the neck of that instrument. But, so yeah, that's another project, sort of kind of side project I enjoy. something I was thinking about doing as a side business was building banjos. It's not an easy thing to do. I've got a lot of the tools that would be needed to do it, but there are a few more I'd have to collect to do it properly. And you know, maybe there's a market out there for the slack banjo.
You know what? You would probably make a mint on that.
I'd buy one.
A mint. and you know, probably not just inside the Linux community, outside it too. If you can make a really good banjo, but inside the Linux community, a Patrick Volkerdig endorsed banjo would, like, I bet you sell like hotcakes.
Yeah, well, I'll keep that in mind. I'll expand the work then.
I would probably buy one.
We're gonna have a Patrick Volkerdig. We're gonna have a Patrick Volkerdig banjo, and we're gonna have a Richard Stallman pan flute or whatever it is that he listens to, right?
No, he plays the pan flute.
That's our new store we're going to do.
Now, didn't you recently, you had...
Yeah, what's that?
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. You were in the middle of saying something.
Well, I wasn't going to say anything too important other than that one of my other hobbies used to be, although it hasn't been for some years, recording concerts. And so if you go out to dd.etree.org, that there are a couple of Grateful Dead concerts that are out there that were tapes that I made years ago. So, and homebrewing used to be another hobby, although I haven't done that in, oh, probably about 8 years, but I still have all the equipment and been thinking about firing the kettle up again, so it could happen.
So how would you record those concerts?
Well, at the time, I didn't own microphones, so I relied on friends who owned microphones. But essentially, we would get special tickets that would put us in a section with other people who were taping, and so we would all be quiet and not, you know, make a lot of noise, get recorded on each other's tape. And we'd get usually lighting stands because they're a little bit more robust. And you know, when you get the drunk person who runs through the middle of the taper section, tries to grab onto something that's sticking up into the air for support, you want it to be pretty sturdy. So you'd take a lighting column and put two microphones up on top of it and run that into a phantom power supply and then run that into a tape deck. And back then I was using a Yamaha 4-track with CDX type 2 noise reduction, and we'd just, you know, put the mics up in the air. Usually we'd use AKG 414s, which are a studio microphone, a large diaphragm condenser microphone. Sometimes we'd use AKG 460Bs or 480Bs, which are smaller condenser microphone, looks more like a, you know, standard looking microphone. Occasionally we would use Nakamichi Nak 300 with the shotgun capsules, which were these really long microphones. And those had extreme directionality to them, so if you ended up placed a long way away from the stage and the PAs, you could them at the PAs, and they had about a 5% off-axis pickup, and so you just aim them straight at the stack and get a pretty good recording that way. That was how we did it.
How did you get that stuff through the front door?
Well, they did. If you had a taper's ticket and the band was sanctioning taping, they would, usually there was a special entrance for the tapers because they had a lot more stuff for the security people to inspect, and they'd go over it all and go, okay, that looks good, you can go in. But they were also, stealth tapers. I guess I stealth taped once at a Page and Plant concert and used the old-fashioned dat down the pants technique, and, you know, there are a few places where the security doesn't want to check you too closely, and so you can get things in.
Yeah, I remember going to concerts with, all I had was like a crappy Walkman that were recording all these, like, little hidden mics on me so I can, and when they do the pat down, I had it like right around my, my belt and crotch area because they never check there.
Yep, that's the hiding spot.
That's Dan for you. Taping a microphone to a tallywhacker.
Seven, a little portable gas wash and four sound microphone. You're probably going to be self-taping. For an indoor concert, if you can get yourself close to one of the stacks, you'd about go deaf, but you'd be great recording.
Awesome. You know what? A couple of standard questions that we usually ask all our guests. Are you a VI or an Emacs guy?
I'm a VI guy. I'm an Elvis guy, even. I like Vim, too, but sometimes I slip into the old modes and I use some of the key commands that I would use on old Unix, and it'll flip the screen or do something else to me on Vim, and I won't know how to get back out of that mode. And so I like Elvis because it's bare bones. It doesn't highlight things. You have to find your own bugs when you're using Elvis.
So then, for a window manager, what do you prefer?
I'm using KDE.
All right. You know, and here's a good question.
I
would assume that on your desktop, and probably most of your systems there, you are using Slackware at home, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Now, does your...
No XP or Windows 2000 or Red Hat, Fedora Core 5 or something like that?
Yeah, what's that?
Link was asking if you're running other operating systems on your systems at home.
At this point, no, I'm not. There are a couple of machines around here that I will confess to having XP on them because they were sold with XP on them. And I left the partitions in place, and it's mostly for compatibility testing because I want to make sure that Grub and Lilo can boot those systems. So, you know, people out there use them, so you have to keep things like that around for testing. As far as other versions of Linux, I have run and do occasionally run other versions of Linux. I've been on mailing lists from other versions of Linux. I've had Red Hat and SUSE send me versions of their products as they come out, and that's nice of them. And it also lets me, you know, check out what's going on with the other versions, and it's good. I get to trade our technology back and forth, and everyone benefits.
So, does your whole family use Slackware?
I guess so. My daughter has, at best, at this point, pounded on the keyboard, but it was at the command line. It was running Slackware, so I suppose the whole family does. And my wife, Andrea, was helping out with kernels during its last development cycle. I put her in charge of 2.6 for a while, so... We are a Linux family.
That's great. That's what I like to hear, because too often I'm hearing people, we run a little Linux here, but we primarily use OS X on the desktop. And I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah. Well, we met in college in the computer lab, and so it's been a technological based and, well, romantically based to relationship from the get-go. So...
That's awesome.
We've kind of gone through this whole Slackware thing together, and it's been good. It's definitely, I would say, to anybody out there who is considering taking on a major open source project, and they're also looking for a girlfriend or looking for a boyfriend or looking for whatever kind of friend, but make sure they're also a geek or they are not going to be able to handle you.
Some good advice. I have two other questions that people are clamoring for me to ask, or for us to ask you. The first question, which should be really easy, is how much time during the week do you spend working on Slackware?
Way too much. I would say from the time that I get up until I call it quits for a day. It can be 12 hours of sitting at the computer and answering email and looking at sites like Fresh Meat to see what's come out and compiling things to test them. I've been trying to take more weekends off, but this last couple of months that led up to the release of Slackware 11, it was essentially sleep and work were the two things that were foremost on my schedule, and I'm getting a little bit of relaxation in now, but not too much. I would say that at the minimum I put 8 hours in.
Great. The other question, which may not be so easy to answer, is what are your opinions on the GPL3 drafts?
I have looked at the GPL version 2 extensively. Version 3, I'm just kind of peripherally familiar with some of the new, like for instance, that they have the non-removal of credit clauses and things like that. And I know that the original BSD license had its the advertising clause, and that a big deal was made out of that, and that now there are people that are saying the GPL is going down the same road with the GPL version 3. I don't really know what's going to happen with that. It's going to be an interesting thing to see how it pans out, because if the GPL2 ends up not being compatible with the GPL3 and Linux, the kernel, decides to stick with the GPL2, then there's going to be some interesting, I don't know what to call it. It would be interesting times, I guess. There's been already quite a lot of that. I know Readline, even back with the GPL version 2, that I would occasionally compile something and it would pick up the Readline library, and I would get a mail from somebody saying, hey, you know, the thing that you just linked with the Readline from GNU is not compatible with the GPL. I'd go, oh, okay, and I'd have to go back and reconfigure with disable Readline, and everyone would be unhappy about that, except for the people who are, you know, really into the making sure that the GPL is followed to the T, which is a good thing. I think that that the GPL serves an important purpose. Sometimes it does things that I think weren't originally intended. Like, just as an example, I still have copies of the very first version of Slackware, but I was keeping the source code in a different spot back then, and I can't find the source code for it anymore. So I've got these original floppy disks, and it'd be fun to put them online for people to take a look at, but I can't do it because I don't have the source code anymore.
Fair enough. That makes sense. Pat, I want to thank you very much for coming on our show this week. It's been a real honor. I mean, we love your distribution. You know, we hope to see many more years of Slackware.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thanks.
Thank you. Good stuff. Thank you very much.
Being on the show, and, you know, thanks a lot again for inviting me to be here. I hope I've been interesting enough for your listeners.
You know what? I don't care. You've been interesting enough to us. That's what matters the most to me. But no, and I hope that
not only that, I hope he wants to come back sometime.
Yeah, we hope that you will, you know, hopefully come back on the show again in the future, talk about, you know, more Slackware goodness, great distribution, and you know, my hat's off to you.
Okay.
And the Slackware team. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Hooray. Well, thank you.
And we'll let you get back to your family now, and we appreciate everything.
Okay.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Pat. I don't think you can hear me, but we all thank
show.
You over here, too.
Thanks again.
All right, you take it easy. Have a good one.
You too.
Talk to you later.
All right.
Good night.
And there we have Patrick Volkerdien.
Yep,
didn't think we'd ever get Pat on this show.
That's right. And My hat's off.
What a great interview.
To Patrick Davila for getting him on the show. And.
Yeah.
And actually, Hold on.
Wait.
Patrick Volkerdig, are you still there? Oh, he must be gone. Okay. I didn't know if he was still there. Anyway. Why is the phone ringing?
That's a good question.
Why is there a phone ringing?
You need help. Hang up and then dial your operator.
How did that happen?
That's funny. He hung up and the connection stayed.
You know what? I'm going to hold on a second. I'm going to come right back in 8100. Let's see if that sticks. Is it still going off?
No, that did the trick.
All right.
I don't know. Did it?
I don't know. But I'm on my...
It'd be pretty funny if it starts ringing again.
let me check the sound levels. I am on my sixth beer. I got to go take a leak. So you guys go ahead and talk.
That's so funny, man.
The nerves did it to Dan. He's like drinking.
I got to take a piss.
For like half an hour now in the other IRC room, he's been saying, yeah, I got to get out of here. I got to take a piss, man. That's so funny.
So what do you guys want to talk about?
That's really funny.
Link, I saw you bought a Nokia 770, man.
I did. I'll hit on that real quick. Most of you guys know that last week, my laptop died, my ThinkPad, and I still haven't even, you know, like, I'm so freaking broke. I haven't even sent the damn thing in to get it an estimate done to get it fixed to see what actually is the problem, right? And that's only like $30. But in the interim, while I'm waiting to get my ThinkPad fixed, hopefully that will be cheap, I had to dig my old laptop out, my old Dell laptop, you know, which is pretty much made out of boulders and rocks for the keyboard and stuff like that because it's so...
We've heard
old.
You tapping over
it's,
there.
Yeah, and it's not only that, but it's like, I noticed that it's like 5,000 pounds to carry around, you know? The
yeah.
ThinkPad was really, really light, and you drop this sucker in there, man, it's pew! And, you know, I need to have a bulldozer or something like that so I can get back and forth to work. But I have it working. I installed Arch on the thing just to get it working really, really fast and try and get something modern on it. And I've been using that for the past couple of days, but it's not great. You know what I mean? It's awful slow.
You're used to the gigahertz.
Used to the snappiness and everything, and you know the ThinkPad just works really, really nice. And my old Dell works, but it does not work really, really nice like the ThinkPad did. But I've been using it, and it's a little slow and kind of annoying in some manners. I can't run like the KDE that I've been using.
No KDE, which is fine, you know.
But the XFCE is fine, and I don't have a problem with that at all. I just kind of, you know, I'm trying to stick to the lightweight applications. And in the interim, while I was doing that, I came across, on one of my mailing lists I'm on, some guy was selling his Nokia 770, like, you know, just slightly used, very good condition. And he's selling it with a gig... RAM card on there. Excuse me. And I've been eyeing Alan's up for the longest time, right? Alan always has the cool... I don't know what the hell he is, man. He's got this money coming in from somewhere. He must be a male prostitute or something.
No kids.
Have a sugar daddy. Because Alan has...
No kids, that's why.
Alan always has the coolest gizmo shit. You know, like the day after it comes out, he's got the Razor, he's got the freaking Nokia 770, you know, he's got the Macintosh going on over there with his
slot machine over there.
His slot machine I'm sitting next to. So I've been eyeing this thing up, this 770, and the guy was selling it, and, you know, I don't have a laptop, really, I don't have a fast laptop, so I figured, all right, I'm going to splurge and get myself a toy. And I picked the 770 up, and it came yesterday. And I've been playing with that for a couple of days. And my impressions of it are, is it a laptop replacement? Absolutely not. No way in hell. I still want my fast laptop back in the worst way. Is it a wickedly cool gizmo toy? Hell yes.
It's a laptop replacement in the fact that, like, you can just whip it out of your pocket and you just whip
and
it
goes,
out.
Yeah.
And if you got to get into, like, a server or something on it to do something real quick, you can just, open it up, get in a session running, VNC
yep.
session or something, and just go in there and do it.
Honestly, you the web app, I would not use it for VNC. VNC really is stinky on it.
Yeah. But, it's something you can use really quick and get it done, that you didn't have to break out the laptop for. But, you couldn't, at least for me, I couldn't replace a laptop.
No. And everybody's saying, $30 to get the laptop check, but bought a 770 for $300 instead. Yes and no, the 771 on my credit card that I haven't actually paid yet. So, that'll come, it'll give me a month, and I'll have to pay that off, too.
But it's well worth the
money. In the interim, I have something, that I can play with. Because, I'm one of those guys that I'm an immediate gratification guy, right? So I spent this money. I can actually play with something while I'm waiting to get money to be able to fix my laptop kind of thing, I guess.
It's worthwhile, though.
It's pretty neat, I still would rather have my laptop fixed. I was hoping that I would get this and go, this is the shit.
I stream the TV, the stuff I record off of Mythbox, I stream onto it.
See, there you go.
So, it's worthwhile for me.
Now, the little, you can watch movies and stuff on this. They're really cool.
Yeah.
They look pretty good. It supports, 25 frames a minute or something like that? Or 25 frames a second?
No, the stuff I'm doing.
Is it 30?
Yeah. I'm doing normal.
Does DivX and XVIDS, right?
It will. There's this Perl script out there that does the conversion for you on it. It uses MPlayer. It's really wicked. You just, send it a file, and it spits out something that's encoded for the Nokia without even thinking about
it.
Yeah,
it takes, a whole DVD and scrunches it down to 70, 80 megs,
if you put it on, if you put it on best quality, it brings it down to, 200 or 300.
Man. But they're really, really nifty, and I highly advocate, if you have a few $100 laying around that you could drop on a small portable Linux device, that's the thing to get.
Toy.
It is a fun toy, and it wows a lot of people.
Yeah, and plus, if you go, if you hang out in coffee shops and stuff like that, it's better than just bringing your laptop if you just want to browse
it's
around.
It's totally convenient to carry around. Fits right in my inside coat pocket, right?
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Yeah. You whip it out and you do your little Linux thing, and it's fine if the stuff you're doing is on a web browser and stuff. You have to browse sites or something like that.
Does PDFs?
It's fantastic. Yeah, it does PDFs too, even though I haven't tried it yet. Does internet radio? You can play movies on it. All that streaming media thing. Really cool. Typing on it.
It takes a while to get used to the typing with the stylus.
Thinking about getting one of those. They say the Bluetooth keyboards work with it, right? But you check out the prices. The Bluetooth keyboards are $100, $150. Holy crap, man.
Well, we have to wait for Mark to build his USB keyboard interface.
I saw one of those little keyboard interface thingies that some guy built on the web. There's plans for it. Apparently, you have to do you have to push power both ways into the Nokia and into the keyboard.
Help.
Yeah, well, pretty much. Well, it's got a return power though.
Oh, okay.
Into the Nokia. There's plans for it on the web. I've seen it, and I can't wait to get a hold of Mark, and I'm gonna make him do it. I'm gonna make him. And then we can try USB keyboards, and it'd be kind of cool too. Because I think you can get a small USB collapsible USB keyboard for $50, which is a whole lot better than $150 for Bluetooth.
It'd be nice to find one. I used to have one for the. I still do. It's floating around in this room somewhere. For the I had a visor, the little palm imitation,
mm-hmm.
for a long time, and it used to have a keyboard that it was the same size as the visor, and basically you just opened it up and it was like an accordion.
Cool.
Slid it together, typed normal. You wanted to break it back up again, you slid the keyboard apart, folded it in two pieces, and it was good to go.
You think that'll work on this stuff?
No, that was a plug-in. Plugged right into the visor. On it, but it would be nice to see if you can find a USB keyboard that was doing the same type of thing.
Yeah.
And fold it up like that.
Yeah. And I also promised, I promised the fine folks over at Prentice Hall that I was going to make mention of some book reviews. They sent me some books. You know, these guys always sending me stuff.
You whore.
They're awesome, awesome. I know. It's, they're awesome people, man. They send me these fantastic books, and like,
that's
sometimes
he
it
smiles
seems,
a lot at that shit.
Ed, that's right. Sometimes it seems like they're reading my mind or something too, because I'll tell you, I was getting into wanting to learn some Python programming, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm gonna have to run out and buy me a Python book and check them out. And no sooner was I, you know, contemplating that, then I got contacted by, you know, Prentice Hall, who happened to want to send me a Python book. And about a week or so later, I got contacted by O'Reilly, who did the same thing. So I have these two monster huge Python books.
I'll take one.
Reviewed on my... You know, bite me. I'm not done reading them yet. They're like 4,000 pages. No,
we were so friendly here. Bite me, damn it.
Bite me. No, I reviewed them. Reviewed them, put them on my... put them on my website, Python, third edition, Python programming, third edition by O'Reilly. And the other one is, if I can get my, you know, I hate this laptop. The other one is Core Python Programming by through Prentice Hall. And both of these are really, really good books. I think the Prentice Hall one is a little bit, geared a little bit more towards the introductory kind of thing. And where that sort of leaves off, the Python 3rd edition from O'Reilly picks up, and you get into a lot of really nifty stuff, you know, mail stuff and CGI and GUI programming and all that kind of stuff. It's really pretty neat. And both really good books. And they also sent me a book on SE Linux, which is Securities and Exchange Linux. And I had forever thought that somehow, mistakenly thought that this was like an actual distribution, right? Like, SE Linux was, you could download SE Linux and
it's an add-on.
Install it on your stuff or whatever. It's what it is.
Or
it's
packages.
A set of like, yeah, it's a set of
software.
It's
enhancements.
No.
Patches.
It is enhancements. It's a set of like scripts and stuff like that and policies that you can use on. I think that the examples of using the book were on like a RHEL4 or something like that. But there's a whole lot of distributions that you can run SE Linux on. And what it is, you create these policies for your security on your system, and they do like security context. Multi-level security, domain transfers, type enforcement, roles, and all kinds of different stuff. And this thing, you know, goes through all of that with you step by step, gives you all kinds of examples and things, and shows you how to create policies to make and enforce all of these rules to keep your, you know, to keep your system secure and safe. And it's really interesting. It's like I said, it's a lot different than I thought it was. I thought it was just another distribution of Linux, and boy, I guess you learn something new every day. You know, if you were a systems administrator or something like that for a bank or, you know, some kind of finance, anywhere really that you really want your data to be safe, like this would be the thing to do, I think.
What you need to look into is how SEC Linux matches up with AppArmor.
Yeah, I probably should look at that. Check it out. The other thing they sent me was embedded Linux, but I'm not going to go into that right here. I'll let some of you guys talk a little bit.
I'm really interested in the Python stuff, man. That's a language I've been dying to learn.
It's, you know, it's pretty cool. I thought it was going to be, for some reason, I thought it was going to be like a Perl offshoot or something. A lot of wacky brackets and crap like that. And it's more like, it's almost like a cross between maybe BASIC and PHP or something like that.
But it has a lot of object-oriented things in it.
It does. There's a lot of OOP stuff in there that you can get into, and it's pretty neat, you know. It's not at all as difficult. You know, it's like a high-level language. It's not at all as difficult as I thought it was going to be.
You don't compile it, right? It's just running it right through the interpreter?
I think there are Python compilers out there. I'm not sure. I'm probably, like, talking crap, but... I think you can get some Python compilers that, probably render it down in a C or something and then compile it out. But it's interpreted for the most part, you know. So, but, you know, it's really cool. I'm going to, you know, spend some time doing, especially now that, you know, I found that, there's this cool Python utility that does, you know, XML, parses XML out and stuff like that. Universal Feed Parser.
Cool.
I was checking out. That's just some neat stuff, man.
I got two things for you there, Link.
Fantastic utilities with that.
I got two things for you.
I don't know if I want to hear your things, man.
First off, I got a great little application you can run on that Nokia. Tux Paint was just a new version was just released, 9.0.9.16. It has slideshow features, some new animated brush features, directional brushes, and some other improvements. So, you know, for you, for your kids, definitely something to check out. Tux Paint, the new version.
Yeah.
And also, I'm probably going to get this wrong because it was made mention to me a couple weeks ago before I got my new job. But apparently, Tux Paint is a little different than Super Tux. But anyway, are you aware of the GTK PHP project?
No.
I'm not sure if I have that right. It might be PHP GTK. But it is... Let me see if I can pull up the website for it. It is writing like standalone app... PHP GTK. GTK.php.net is an extension for the PHP programming language that implements language bindings for GTK+. It's kind of like bringing PHP down to the desktop level instead of requiring it a complete server. And it's integrated with Apache that you can actually write PHP applications for GTK. And create desktop applications with GTK too and PHP. So, again, I'll put the link in the forum, but... Not the forum, the IRC, but it's gtk.php.net. Looks pretty promising. It's still, like, I think, alpha-level development. But it looks really promising to decouple PHP from a web server and bring it right down to the desktop.
You can use it now as a... you can use PHP in a shell environment. Mm-hmm. It works really well.
Yeah, what is that to do that? I forget what that's called.
PHP.
Right, but I mean this allows you to get a you know graphical interface, you know, and different things like that. The ease of PHP and put it on you know top of GTK too.
Gorgon is saying, Linky, you got to write a GUI now.
New GUI for Bash Potter, right?
Running in Python.
Maybe, yeah.
Python Potter. Or Bash Python.
GTK PHP.
Oh, no, it would be called
I was thinking about
PY
doing
Bash
like
Potter.
Anyway.
PY Bash Potter.
PY Bash Potter. Bash Potter PY.
There you go.
Something.
PY Potter. Pea Potter.
I think they have one for that already, right?
They probably do. Potter. You know, speaking of podcasts... and it's great that DistroWatch is back, but one of the things I keep hearing across a lot of some of these Linux-based podcasts is that they're on the fence about AUX support, and time again they're like, well, you know, maybe we won't supply AUX support because, you know, not as many people subscribe to the AUX as the MP3.
Wait a second, let me stop you right there.
What?
Who is saying this?
I've heard it on...
Who is saying that? They're not going
to
put shows.
I heard it on DistroWatch. I heard it on, I think, Linux Log. But
Pat's going to write them nasty emails.
Both of those shows do provide AUG feeds. They do provide AUG feeds. But I hear that creating the AUG feed takes so much more time. And to me, I don't understand that because when I encode the shows... The first one I do is the AUG, and that's the first one finished. And to do the MP3 only takes like another few, actually takes longer for me to encode the MP3 than it does the AUG. And it's just surprising because the AUG is so much bigger than the MP3 because we include all that extra content in the AUG. So I just find it kind of odd.
You know what pisses me off? There's podcasts that are now switching from MP3 to AAC. All the Apple-based people, and it's pissing me off.
I wouldn't know that because I don't listen to any of those.
Yeah.
There's a couple of them that do that. Like, one of them was the Galactica Sit Rep, which is like a Battlestar Galactica podcast. The guy talks about episodes and news and stuff. So all of a sudden, you know, the latest show file shows up as an AAC, so I sent the guy an email, and he switched it back to MP3 after that. So, you know, thanks to him.
Well, you know, I would suspect...
Guy, like, Pat's ripping him a new asshole.
that was nice about it.
What the hell are you doing with the AAC, man? I'm going to come over there and kill your children or something.
Some people may do that because, one, you can get the content that shows up in your iPod when you do that. You can encode content. But the other half is also usually like half the size of an MP3.
Yeah.
On it. So, you know, people know that most people are listening, you know, if they know that most of their listening audience is using an iPod, they may switch over to that just because they can save bandwidth, too.
Yeah, I guess. Well, the guy switched it back. I mean, not for nothing. Not that many people run Apple.
Give him hell. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but I was going to say...
AAC and my OG player.
I would suspect that's probably one of the big reasons why you're seeing more shows show up from AAC, as a lot of them are probably doing... GarageBand, and GarageBand, I suspect, defaults to releasing the podcast in AAC as opposed to MP3, and God forbid, AUG.
Sounds like Dan knows an awful lot about releasing podcasts in GarageBand, doesn't it?
No, you know what?
He's a secret GarageBand user.
No, I haven't used GarageBand in
years. Now we find out the truth. That's where the tech show comes from, right?
No, but really.
Mixing it up in GarageBand.
When I was working at the school district, you know, GarageBand, the last version that came out was all about podcast support, and that their big thing was, well, you know, you just export it right out to Apple's... What was that? The web
out to AIF?
It goes AIF out to their Apple format. It shoots right up with their iWeb or whatever it is, and integrates seamlessly with iTunes. So it's all, you know, Apple proprietary crap.
Fuck them.
But they make it so easy to do.
Hey, did you guys see our new TLLTS website on MySpace?
That was great.
That's funny, man.
I love the hot pink animated fonts.
I couldn't stop laughing with that one.
That is some funny shit.
Thanks,
man.
To Wally, I guess. Wally, I guess. Is
yeah, Ben, man. You're the best, man. Oh, that's funny. We all got a good laugh at it.
But have we gotten any friends on it yet?
Yeah, there is one. Hoagie Guy got a friend.
Hoagie Guy got my niece as a friend.
I would have to issue a complaint about that site, my only complaint about that site, it's too readable. Okay,
it's right.
Yeah, you can actually
too much of a problem
read it. We need to make the text, some of the text on there, like about two shades off of the background,
black and a dark brown background or something like that,
and then make it all transparent and more. So, and it plays meets spin round round. That's what it plays, right? Round round.
Oh man,
that's so great.
That was classic.
I
like the two-headed. Alan's got the Link's head sitting next to him. You see that?
The two-headed Link.
Yeah, those are
back from the GIMP experiment.
Yeah, Wally Balljacker really went back in time and pulled those pictures out. I don't think he has.
I didn't even know where they were.
He doesn't have the drug dogs on there, does he? Does he have the dog picture on there? Right, let me go.
No, God,
they weren't on
the
there. God, you gotta be kidding.
The drug dog. But that's so great. It needs, if Wally Balljacker is going to do that, he needs to keep it updated too, because it's funny as hell, and we need to see more. And for those who don't know, it's myspace.com/TLLTS. Great stuff.
Make sure you turn the volume up for it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man.
You need to get the hot link on that page.
Yeah, and then somebody went and subscribed to the forum.
Nobody needs to get hot link.
Yeah, somebody subscribed to our forum with the hoagie guy. So we got a hoagie guy on the forum.
I'll let you. That's funny.
And speaking of the forums, we should probably make mention of this, that now we have a require that admin approval before you actually get subscribed.
Yes.
And because Lug,
what prompted us to do this?
Yeah, Lug Radio got nailed.
Oh yeah, the other night, man. They had that hundreds of posts.
Right.
And it's gotta suck, you know. And you wonder what the hell these people are thinking. Like, do they really think that if they spam a forum or a mailing list, that somebody's gonna go, "Hey, no, I really want to stay hard for 6 hours."
We need penis patches. You know?
But don't they tell you on the commercials if that happens, you have to seek medical attention?
Yeah, right. If you have an erection for more than 4 hours, seek medical attention, and then you go to your email and it says stay hard all night long. You know? So which is it, man?
Soft hands.
Well, you know what? When they do that, they spam a form like that. That increases their hit count in search engines.
So people are paying them for their hit count in search engines?
Right. So that increases, you know, the more sites that they're actually on. And, you know, a search engine will pull that out and say, well, hey, they spam Lug Radio 100 posts on there. So then their link count goes up or something like that. And then they get a higher ranking in a search engine. But it is obnoxious.
You would think that they'd get paid when people actually buy the shit, you know?
Yeah, because I'm deleting, like...
You know, what's obnoxious is Frapper Map spam. For a while, we were getting Frapper Map spam, but that kind of died out a little bit.
Yeah, I'm good they're keeping up with that, but I'm, like, killing, you know, 5 or 6 new accounts a day that are just spam, and probably more than that, but on average, 5 or 6 new accounts that are spammers. And, you know, they all do the same shit, you know? They all put in, like, the most obvious things. That you know, you can tell they're spammers right away because it's either Viagra or you know, it's ridiculous. And for those people who want to sign up
by the way, check out this link.
Yeah, for those people who want to sign up on our forums, and I put a post on there and made it sticky at the top. If you're going to sign up, you know, put something in there that kind of lets us know that you know you're a legitimate user, like you know, some interests that include Linux or whatever. And stuff like that, because those people who are not legitimate users to our forum aren't gonna they post stuff like pharmaceuticals or you know, advertising as their interest, which is ridiculous, and I'll kill it right off the bat. And I'll also kill anybody that doesn't put anything. If it's just a blank account, I'll pretty much kill it, because it's not worth it to have to go back and clean it up. Yeah.
Yeah. What right. Dan said.
And you know what, Link? Maybe you better make an announcement about Bash Potter, because we get trickles in about that.
Yeah, it's been updated for what? A couple of months now?
Only.
If you run Bash Potter, you know, go get the latest version.
Yeah, if our show's coming in as mirror.php.
This is a public service.
Yep. Yeah, keep getting emails to the tech show list, to me personally, here and there, talking about how Bash Potter doesn't download the latest episode of the tech show. That's because you haven't upgraded. So upgrade your Bash Potter.
I had one quick thing before we head out. I noticed, I saw that the Dell guys, there's a contingent of Linux people at Dell, and they're actually showing up in the SUSE planet listing. And sure enough, I went to the Dell website. They're selling Dell desktops, all the different series, with no OS. What they do is they ship you free DOS. On an average, they're $20 to $30 cheaper than what Windows version is. So that's what they're paying for Windows, basically, $30.
Yeah, it's crazy because they, you know, the Microsoft tax is like $200, right?
They must be paying $30.
Getting subsidized. That's well, you know, Microsoft wants them to get their stuff on it.
I'm not sure they're paying so much as $30, but they might actually be paying more than $30. In that, I think one of the other economic factors involved there is the extra software that they usually include with it. might bring down the price of the,
well, the crap
license. So, yeah, so you get like the Norton or the McAfee and maybe a few other pieces of software on there. If you have the Windows install, which might drive the price down, license price down a little more. So if they don't include that, I don't know. I'm gonna be talking out my ass.
Well, they need to do better. Is all I have to say.
Yep.
They need to send it with. You know what? I'm glad they're doing it. It's a step in the right direction, but I'm still gonna buy System 76.
Exactly, it's a step.
Right.
There you go.
And Firefox 2.0 released this week.
Yep.
Yes, it did.
Fedora Core 6 also.
Fedora Core 6.
And Edgy's coming out, I think, tomorrow, the day after.
27th, I thought
it
was.
Right, did they say, like, Thursday?
Yeah, 27th, 2 days.
Friday.
No, that's one day.
Lots of good releases, lots of good stuff are coming out.
This is it. This is the month of, and don't forget, Daylight Savings Time this month.
How can it be?
For those people who practice it.
Fall back.
Sorry, Link.
Shall I do some Frapper shout-outs?
Frapper it, man.
Frapper it, baby. We've got Neil Cherry, who we had on as a guest from Monroe Township, New Jersey.
Yeah.
John Wright from Macomb, Georgia. Joe Henderson from Sacramento, California. We've got Joe Hollid from Willow, Alaska. Another Alaska listener. Annie from Millersburg, Ohio. Fed from Los Angeles, California. And Steve Riley from Norwich, New York.
Awesome. I know where Norwich is. I got family that lives in Lansing. I wonder if anybody knows where that is.
Probably related to him.
Now, I got a question.
It's a pretty big town up there.
I got a question.
Go ahead.
Two questions. First off, did somebody change their nickname to Volker D on the IRC, or is that actually Pat that's on there?
That's Pat.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know he was on the IRC. How many people did you say we have on our Frapper map?
818.
We need 1,000.
I'm getting closer.
That's the only thing that Alan says every damn show, you know?
You're going to keep hearing me annoy you until we get to 1,000.
Well, I don't know if we're going to make it to 1,000, because now we have Pat on, and now that's it. Who else could we get on, guest-wise, right?
Nah. Venus, that's about it.
And speaking of guests, who's up next week, Pat?
Secret guest.
Oh, we've maxed out. We got, Pat Volkerding on the show. Everybody else is like downhill from here, you know?
Yep. Oh, that's good.
We've reached the pinnacle with Patrick Volkerding.
Right. Way to promote, coming on our show by saying you're nothing but second rate. That's great.
Yeah, nothing but second rate. We finally got Patrick Volkerding on the show,
Life's a bitch.
I guess we'll have you on. You can talk for 5 minutes or whatever.
Awesome.
Now, we got a secret guest. I'll give you guys a hint. We got a secret guest, and I'm sure the topic will be GPL version 3.
Oh.
And the pan flute.
Ooh, I wonder who that
is. Bulgarian folk dance.
Has this guest ever been on before?
Yes.
Yeah. I actually look forward.
Don't give it all away now.
I actually look forward to speaking with this guest, because I really enjoyed him or her the first time around, and I'm sure I will enjoy it the second time around. Don't forget to check out the TLLTS wiki.
Dan, play us out.
Okay, I got some. I did a lot of CD ripping this weekend to populate on my jukebox, and everything was going fine. And then today, for some reason, it just stopped playing. And when I came home, I had a hard drive failure on it. And I'm hoping that the system stays up from now on, which is the clue.
Got on there and did RMSRF.
Yeah, I don't know, because that's going to really disappoint me if I'm going to lose all this stuff that I ripped on there, and it's not going to work anymore.
Moral of the story: do your backups, dude.
You know what? Honestly, I don't have the space to back up this stuff, and it's on my MP3 server, my AUG MP3 server, whatever.
What was your MP3 server?
It's up and running now, so. I'll stream it from work tomorrow, see if it goes down again. But anyway, because I couldn't use that today, I went over to Magnatune and started streaming stuff off of Magnatune. And I was primarily listening to the punk rock section, so I got a song from a group called the Jackalopes tonight from Magnatune. And if you're listening from work or with other people in the car or wherever you're listening, and this is not for all audiences, it's not a safe work song. It's primarily geared towards more adult listening. So turn off your stereo or your system now. Come back for the AUG stuff, whatever. Anyway, the song is, I think I'm playing Pristine 15 tonight from the Jackalopes. You'll enjoy this. And I want to thank everybody for listening. And I want to thank especially Patrick Volkerdig and the Slackware community for all the work that they've done.
You betcha.
Yeah.
Slack. That's it. So I guess that's it, guys. I'm going to play us out of here.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
And you guys will be able to enjoy the song, too. Here we go.
I got followed by so many guys. I don't know if the father's going to be white, Indian, Mexican, or black.
We'll be right back. That was track number 6 from the album Jaxploitation by Jackalopes from Magnatune.com.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush.
Shut up. Just shut up. Over.
That's it. Thank you for listening. Thank everybody for participating. And especially thank Patrick Volkerdig for coming on. Fantastic.